We are studying in chapter 8 of Romans, and we are coming close to the end of the chapter, but we're not going to get there tonight. We are going to be looking this evening at verse 37 in chapter 8, Paul's statement, as it's translated in the New American Standard, is, "But in all these things we overwhelmingly conquer through him who loved us." And that's a better and more accurate translation than the one that the AV has in the online Bible or whatever other you may have. That's almost word for word exactly what the Greek text says. Now, we've been looking in our study into the question that is raised first in verse 31. If God is for us, who can be against us? And we've seen that the issue that has surfaced that question is the unjust treatment of believers by this world and those who wield power in it, which is everybody who's in this world, because all of us have the ability to function. And once we have the ability to function, we do things, and things we do have an effect, and they run out from us, and they impact others, whether we intend it to be that way or not. And when ungodly people do ungodly things, everybody suffers, regardless of their own condition of godliness or ungodliness. And the main thing, though, in chapter 8 of Romans is, starting in verse 17, the issue of suffering with Christ, which means it's an unjust thing. So when we're treated badly by others, it creates some problems for us. And in our study last time, we actually considered the reality in verse 36 that God permits those who trust in him to be accounted as sheep for slaughter. That's what it says. We are considered as sheep to be slaughtered all day long for your sake. And given that reality, there are problems that people come up with. It flies in the face of almost everybody's concept of love to have the idea that somebody who loves you can allow you to be accounted as a sheep for slaughter. Most folks think that if you treat a person as a sheep whose destiny is to be killed, you don't love them. And in that case, most folks are correct. If you treat somebody as a sheep who is to be slaughtered, it's wicked. It's not love to kill somebody. But though most folks are right about that, most folks also run that line out a bit further, and they say that if you have the power to stop somebody from killing somebody, you're not loving if you don't use your power to do so. And that's the bottom line for the next step that they're going to take, and that step is, say they, since God is omnipotent and could stop any act of evil if he decided to, he must not be loving if he doesn't. We have laws on the books in our country that hold you accountable for not acting when you could have acted to stop some bad thing from happening. And we think that's a legitimate law. But it's not. By that logic, the entire gospel would be destroyed. God wouldn't have allowed Christ to die for us, and we would have no hope, no redemption, and we'd be lost entirely. Not only that, we wouldn't even be here. Because if God was going to stop evil before it occurred, he'd have to stop us before we did any. And the only way he can do that is to kill us. So, by the false logic of extending that idea out, that if you allow somebody to be treated as a sheep for slaughter, when you could do something to stop that slaughter, and you don't, if you run that way, you will be in a mess shortly, and you'll be really antagonized by God. By the logic of if you can stop it and you don't, the question arises, what does it matter if God is for us, if he lets us be treated like sheep headed for the slaughter pen? What's the big deal about God being for us if he's just going to let us be slaughtered? That's why this passage is written. There are three facts that confront this logic and make it illogic. The first fact is this. Love becomes a complex issue as soon as there are multiple objects of love in the mix. Because as soon as you have more than one person to love, then you have to start making choices about who's going to get the majority love effort on any given day, at any given point. And if you do that, then this person may actually be in the way of that, and they will get run over in the process of you loving this person more than you love that person. That's the Romans 9, Jacob have I loved and Esau have I hated. In that context, God is deciding who's going to be in the messianic lineage, and there are two possibles. And he says, well, I love Jacob. I'm going to let him be, and Esau is not going to be. It's called hated. It's not emotionally loaded. It's just the fact that there are certain things. As soon as love becomes multi-object, it becomes very complex. And that's the first thing that makes this whole reasoning process illogical that we addressed already. The second fact is this. None of the higher qualities of love can be developed in undeveloped lovers if the occasions for them are disallowed. Let me say that this way. The permission of sin is the only setting in which the host of the higher qualities of love can even be brought to light, let alone developed in less than loving creatures. For example, selflessness will never be even seen or developed if there is no occasion for somebody having to give up something for somebody else's sake. You'll never see forgiveness if there is nothing to be forgiven. You can't call for sacrifice as a high example of love when there is no need for a sacrifice. And you can't talk about extreme loyalty and a whole bunch of other things if there are no occasions that challenge those things. Jesus said it this way, there is no greater love than laying down your life for your friends. Well, if that's the greatest expression of love, then if you don't have any occasion to lay down your life because of your friend's need, that would be an evil setting. If that's never there, then you'll never see the greater manifestation of love. You won't. Can't. And not only will you not see it, you won't develop it yourself. Paul qualified Jesus' statement about greater love hath no man than that he laid down his life for his friends in Romans 5:8, because there he told us that God's friendship extends to sinners. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. So though we weren't his friends, he apparently considered us to be his. We didn't consider him to be our friend, but he considered us to be his. Or the greater love hath no man doesn't fit. I mean, if you're going to say it like this, greater love hath no man than he give his life for his enemies. That's not what Jesus said. He said for his friends. The fact that Jesus laid down his life for those who hated him only means that he had extended friendship status to them. That's the only way I can reconcile it. So that's the second fact. None of the higher qualities of love would even be manifest, let alone developed in less than loving creatures. And when I say that, I mean this. God can't create God. If he's going to create person, he's going to create a whole lot less than God. And that means the attributes of God are going to have to be developed in those creatures, even if they don't disobey him. They're still going to have to develop them. Even the angels who didn't sin are gaining in their grasp of the glory of God and learning and growing by the things they observe God doing in the church on this earth. So that's the second fact. Multiple objects make love complex. None of the higher qualities of love are manifest or developed without a setting that permits that. And thirdly, it's only the unloving who complain about the cost of love. Short and simple. If I were loving, I wouldn't mind paying the price. So it's only the unloving who complain about the cost of loving. So those three things make it a very ludicrous thing to challenge God's love based on His permission of evil in this creation. However, even in the love of God, the permission of evil has its boundaries. It is never allowed to move to the level of final destruction. It is never presented as a permanent feature in the plans of God for those who embrace the principles of love. He's going to separate out the creatures so that those who have embraced the kingdom principles, love and faith, are not ever going to be subjected to the death impact of sin once God's educational process of this creation has been accomplished. It's never presented as a permanent feature, though there is a permanent hell, but those people are separated out. It's permanent for them, but it's not permanent for those who are loved. And it's never allowed to succeed in any real sense of that term. Succeed. The wages of sin are always death, and God has decreed the absolute subversion of the intentions. That's where we come in our study this evening in verse 37. All of that was introduction. This evening, I want to zero in on Paul's declaration that in God's permission of evil in His creation, He has never, ever said that He will allow it to succeed. God has decreed the absolute subversion of the intentions of evil. Romans 8:28 is as clear a statement of that subversion as you'll find. God taking evil and turning it into good. And He says, all things are turned into good. So this evening, what we're going to do is look at verse 37 under the thesis that evil is never allowed to succeed in any real sense. Paul's way of saying it is this: in all these things, we overwhelmingly conquer. Overwhelming conquering means the other side lost. It didn't succeed. So in order to study this, I want to look at some of the actual statements of the text. If you have an authorized version, King James or that variation, it says, nay. But that's not the word, not even in the TR, the Textus Receptus, the Greek text behind the AV. The word is Allah. It means but. And the but is in direct contrast to verse 36. We are counted as sheep for the slaughter every day, but! It's the strongest adversative in the Greek language, and it deliberately sets the issue of being accounted as a sheep for the slaughter in opposition to its theoretical significance. The theory behind being accounted as a sheep for slaughter is set against reality. In theory, being accounted as a sheep for slaughter means being destroyed. In theory, being counted as a sheep for slaughter means being subject to the hatred of God. In theory, being counted as a sheep for slaughter means that everything of value in faith is being flushed down the toilet. In theory, that's where men go with the idea of being counted as a sheep for slaughter. I'm going to be destroyed. God must hate me. Everything that's valuable to me, everything I believe, has just been down the tube because dead sheep. But that's just the theoretical unbelieving reality. In the truth, the but, verse 37, but in real truth, in reality, being counted as a sheep for slaughter means being set up for phenomenal glory. You remember verse 17? If we suffer with Him, we will also be glorified with Him. So, in reality, if you're counted as a sheep for slaughter, you're being set up for enormous glory. That's the reality. You're not going to be destroyed. You're going to be glorified. Secondly, in reality, being counted as a sheep for slaughter means being absolutely set within the boundaries of the values and loyalty of God. That's verse 35. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Nothing. Absolutely set within His love and the things that are true and his loyalty. And in reality, thirdly, being counted as a sheep for slaughter means that everything of real value and real truth is being established forever. That's verse 37. We are overwhelmingly conquering. So the but in verse 37 is deliberate. It's intentional to get us to think about the way the world looks at being counted as a sheep for slaughter and the way the child of God is instructed to look at that, because the worst possible thing about that is physical death, and you're going to do that anyway. I mean, so nobody treats you like a sheep to be slaughtered. Nobody comes along and whacks your head with a hammer and knocks you dead. Well, you get 80, 90 years old, and you just fall over dead, okay? You're dead in either case. And that's the worst possible thing that can happen to you. The rest of it is covered under the promises of God. So in reality, none of the things that the world thinks about being counted as a sheep for slaughter are true. And then the second thing is, in all things. This is deliberate. In this context, the all things is deliberate, and it's all of these things. That's what the text says. In all of these things. What things? Tribulation, distress, persecution, famine, nakedness, peril, sword, being counted like a sheep for the slaughterhouse. Those things. In all of those things, we are overwhelmingly conquerors. Now, I want you to remember that in our former studies of this passage, that these things are those named factors that were designed by their perpetrators to control our love for God and to corrode it, so that, in their thinking, God's love for us will then be corroded likewise. In other words, the idea is the perpetrators of persecution and distress and tribulation and famine, nakedness, peril, sword. Those that do that kind of thing to people, those who treat people like sheep to the slaughter, they're doing that on purpose. And for them to do it to faithful believers, because that's the context here, they're doing it to try to break down their faithfulness. And it's not just to break it down. In their thinking, if you break down the faithfulness of the people of God, you'll break the faithfulness of God to his people. Because in their mind, they can't conceive of a God who would say, even if you are disloyal, I'll remain loyal. They can't conceive of that. They think, okay, if we can get them to rebel against God, then God will turn his back and walk away. And the vast majority of Christians believe that. But it's a lie. That's what it says here. It's a lie. Keep that in mind. All of the things that are being perpetrated are designed to corrode your love for God so that his love will be corroded toward you. And there's no denying the short-term corrosive effect of these things upon our love for Christ. How many times have we walked away from him because of tribulation, distress, persecution, famine, nakedness, peril, sword, or some lesser thing, a lot less than that? How many times have we denied our loyalty over some minor something, pot of beans, a mess of pottage, whatever? But the key interpretive issue of this text is not whether he can be separated from our love. It's whether we can be separated from his. He didn't say, who shall separate Christ from our love? Shall tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword or being counted like a sheep for the slaughterhouse? Because, folks, yeah. But that wasn't the question. The question is, can those things be used to separate us from his love? And that's key. The interpretation of this text has to start with the right question. It has to ask the right question. And the right question is, who will separate us from his love? Not who will separate him from our love. So when it says all of these things, he's still talking about those things that were designed to try to get God to stop loving us. And then we come to the verb itself. We overwhelmingly conquer. That's the word for being a victor with a hyper emphasizer on the front. It's actually hooper. That's where we get our word hyper from. But it means that it's intensifying it. That's why it says overwhelmingly in the translation. We conquer abundantly above. What does that mean? Well, it doesn't mean there's no defeat of any kind or in any sense. Paul isn't denying in verse 37 what he wrote in the first half of the chapter where he talked about if you walk according to the flesh, you will die. He isn't denying Romans 6:23 that the wages of sin is death. He's not saying there's no defeat of any kind in any sense, because that would deny everything he's been talking about, how damaging sin is. Death is real. And he's not making light of it, but he is declaring something about it, and that is that the core objective of the evil is going to be absolutely frustrated. You don't tell people that they're overwhelmingly conquering if they're actually being defeated. So, what is the defeat? Well, what was the intention of the perpetrators of all of this wicked stuff? To stop God from loving us. Is that going to happen? According to this text, it hadn't got a snowball's chance in the hot place. It isn't going to happen. We're overwhelmingly victorious. It may not be a small thing for certain incidentals to be accomplished. The death impact of sin is real. But if the main objective is overwhelmingly defeated, what difference does it make if the lesser objectives were accomplished? What difference does it make to the vanquished that he got a few good licks in if he lost? And if the intention is from the evil one, his goal is to separate us from the love of God. And that's why he does what he does. So what if he gets a few licks in and never accomplishes that? His rage is going to go forever in Gehenna, because he's going to be absolutely defeated. So all Paul's really doing here, he's not minimizing the death impact of sin. He's not telling us that it doesn't matter whether we're loyal or not, whether we trust God or not. He's not saying it doesn't matter. He's just saying core issue is not going to be realized by the adversaries. The core issue. The issue, though, that I want us to finish our study on is not quite that. I mean, I'm not saying and we're going to be through in a couple minutes, because we're not, but I want us to go out of here thinking about the operative terminology that we overwhelmingly conquer through him who loved us. Because that through him issue means that our conquering is by his activity in his love for us. The terminology actually compels what I'm just going to call grace orientation. And what is a grace orientation? It is the understanding that God acts for us to meet the requirements that are upon us so that we get credit for them because he did them when we trust him. That means that a grace orientation is always going to be looking for God's activity to accomplish the need. Now, God's activity to accomplish the need may sometimes look human, because he may use some human to accomplish his end. But even if it does look human, it doesn't eliminate him from being the real cause. The issue of a grace orientation doesn't mean you sit on your keister and do nothing all day long because God is going to do everything and give you credit because you're trusting him. That's not it. Trust is an act of dependence as you're going about your rat killing. And God is using your rat killing to accomplish his purpose if you're trusting him when you're doing it. And it doesn't matter what it is, as long as it's within the boundaries of what he's said. Because God uses some of the strangest activities to accomplish the neatest ends, and we don't even realize it. Because he said, I will guide you with my eye upon you. You trust me, I'll oversee your life. Okay, so here you are. Let me just give you this. It just popped in my mind. The first year I came to know the Lord, I was in high school and I was working as a what they call distributive ed student. I went to school in the morning and I went to work in the afternoon, and my job was in an auto repair shop. And the main mechanic, there was only two stalls, and there was a main mechanic, and then I was hired to help him. And the main mechanic was a drunk, so he spent most of his time across the street in a bar if there wasn't any real work that needed to be done. And if there was some work, I could do it, and he could be over there drinking. Well, the boss got tired of that after a while and fired him and hired me to be his mechanic. He said, if you run into something you can't handle, just come ask me, and I'll help you work it out. So one of the perks of being the mechanic was that my boss would let me use the shop and the tools and all that after hours if I wanted to work on something I wanted to work on. And I had a friend in high school who had an Oldsmobile that wasn't running quite right, and I said, well, why don't you come by the shop after hours and we'll see if we can fix it. And he did. I had just become a believer a little while before that, so while I was working on the carburetor on his car, I was telling him about Jesus. And he put his trust in the Lord. Now, who would have thought that a person could be born into the family of God because they went to get their car fixed by somebody because the carburetor was messing up? You can almost see God's finger in the carburetor messing it up to get him to go, you know. This is the way God works. He said, I'll guide you. Trust me. I'll make it work. That's the way it works. So it's a grace orientation. God is the one who's doing the work. Now, in the grace orientation concept, we're brought face to face with Paul's most fundamental perspective in all of his theology, and that is substitutionary or vicarious interplay. That means somebody else is doing the real work. The thing that you have to keep in mind is that for Paul to be able to declare in verse 37 that we overwhelmingly conquer through him, that he's telling us that he did something that makes us the overwhelming conquerors. Remember, he gives us credit when we trust him. Well, that triumph theology is rooted in the concept of grace. That's rooted in this substitutionary, vicarious theology, somebody doing something for somebody else in their place for their benefit. It's the old David and Goliath imagery. In the David and Goliath imagery, the issue is this. You got the armies of the Philistines over here, and you got the armies of Israel over here, and they're going to have it out. But somebody suggests, I think it was the Philistines, they said, look, there's no point in all of our armies and all of our people fighting. We've got one soldier that we'll send out, and he'll meet with whatever soldier you choose, and whatever happens when these two fight will be the deal for the whole army and the nations that they represent. So they sent out their champion. He was 9 feet tall, had a spear with it, like a, you know, covered with armor, big old giant of a guy, big bruiser. They said, here's our champion, where's yours? And even Saul said, oh, I'm not going out there. And poor little old David had been sent to take some food to his brothers, and he heard this big old loudmouthed Philistine warrior every morning. Hey! Where's your fighter? Let him come out here and fight! And David looked around, and there's nobody going out there. He said, what's the matter with you people? And his brother all crawled over. You know, it's the older brother and the little brother. Shut your fat mouth! You know what you're talking about. David said, I'll go out there. God delivered the lion into my hand. He delivered the bear into my hand. He'll deliver that loudmouth into my hand, too. I'll go out there. And the Lord will deliver him Now, who slung the stone? That was David. For all the world, it looked like David won. Even all of the women in Israel on the triumphal march back into town, Saul has slain his thousands, David his 10,000, you know. They're all giving David the credit, but David knows who guided that stone, who made it fly hard enough to embed itself in the forehead of that loudmouthed Philistine. David knew. It was his theology that when you operate by faith, God's at work to accomplish the objective. He didn't take credit for it. He did it under the concept of grace. He did it under the concept of substitutionary or vicarious theology. The issue of that theology is nobody else does anything except the surrogate, but everybody experiences whatever the surrogate's actions bring about. The Philistines all lost the battle. The Israelites all won. They were overwhelmingly conquerors by one little rock out of a sling of a little guy. Because he did the work, they got all the benefits. Well, that's really the issue of vicarious theology. That's the issue of grace. God doing for you what is required and then giving you the credit even though you didn't do anything. He did it. You know, in a modified sense, that's really the issue everywhere you turn. Think about it. I don't know, some of you are not sports fans at all, but we get this vicarious thrill when our team wins. And we didn't do anything except watch. It's called a vicarious thrill. Because they did it, we get the joy. Well, think about it in warfare. An army, seen as a single entity, represents a nation that fielded it. There is this whole host of non-combatant civilian types in this nation, and they say, we're not going to do anything. You do it. So they send their army as a unit out there to do it for them. So from that perspective, you still have this vicarious thing. You do it, give me the experience of the benefit of whatever it is you accomplish. That's the issue even with an army. But the same thing's true within the context of that army. Let's say that you're in that army, and you're one of the soldiers. And your general says, charge! And you jump up, and somebody, pow! And you just fall over completely unconscious. And that's the end of the battle for you. But when your buddies have cleaned the plow of the enemies, and they come pick you up and take you back to the hospital and bandage up your head and give you an Excedrin, you're the victor too. You didn't do anything except get whacked in the head after you jumped up. So within the context and outside of it, even the whole idea of warfare is vicarious. An enormous amount of life is that way. You don't have to be a soldier to be an overwhelming conqueror. You just have to be on the right side. So, that's what the concept of being an overwhelming conqueror is. It's through Him who loved us, not through us who loved Him. The confusion really does enter the picture, though, at the actual level of the activities that are going on, the actions that are being taken. Like I said, David is the one who walked out there. He's the one who did this with his sling. He's the one who let it go. He's the one who ran over after the rock embedded itself in his forehead and knocked him to the ground and took his sword and cut his head off. David did all of those actions. And that confuses people because they think then it was David that did it. It was not David that did it. He knew better. He said, the Lord will deliver that guy into my hand. And you know, it's only because there's this huge swell of rebellion in the human race and a refusal to be at one with their surrogate that we now have all of these theologies of salvation by your performance. The free will, which is really self-will idea, where you put in your 2 cents worth. If you're willing to accept the oneness with Jesus that God offers you, then you get credit for everything he did. If you believe in him, you are an overwhelming conqueror. If you do nothing, the thief that died on the cross was that day with Jesus in paradise. After having lived his whole life as a rebel and an ungodly man. All of that works theology is really just a way to say, look what I've accomplished. God's having none of that. There's arrogance in that. God is the one who does for us. He's the one who makes us overwhelming conquerors. And we are. What he's basically saying is, because God has set his affection upon you, you have become one of his children. There's nothing that's going to stop his pursuit of your life under his love. Nothing. That's what it means. Okay, questions or comments? The phenomenal thing about the wisdom of God is that in the rebelliousness of unbelief, men have all these plans that they're going to accomplish by these means, and God turns every one of them upside down in terms of their intention. He uses the worst they can handle, dump on him to accomplish the greatest good. Because that's in his wisdom, boy, it's just completely opposite ours. And being opposite means, well, here's another illustration. My mom used to, when I was a teenager before I came to know the Lord, I had a violent temper. And my mom used to say, I love it when you get mad when I tell you to go get the weeds out of the garden because you're so angry you're just pulling those weeds out. You know? And she gets what she wants done out of my rage. That's exactly the way God does with men. He turns their foolishness by his wisdom into whatever it was he wanted to accomplish. Okay, anything else? Well, let's have a word of prayer. Father, we're grateful to you that your word is true and that you have declared your willingness and your ability to bring us to the fulfillment of all the things you promised. As we go through our dailies, we pray that you would remind us so that we will not be overcome, even in a small thing. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.